Good evening. I'd like to read some verses out of Job chapter 12. Job chapter 12, readings verses 7 through 10. And I'll be reading out of the NIV. But ask the animals, and they will teach you, or the birds in the sky, and they will tell you, or speak to the earth, and it will teach you, or let the fish in the sea inform you. Which of all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is the life of every creature and the breath of all mankind. So, you may have seen some things up here on the table. Tonight I'm going to be talking about bees. So when you talk about bees, therefore you talk about honey and honeycomb and some of that. So it is one of the many creatures that God created, and we are to ask the animals and they will teach us. So we'll see what we can learn tonight. A bee is an insect. It's one of the most useful insects, and there's about 20,000 species or kinds of bees. Bees live in almost every part of the world except somewhere close to the North or the South Pole. Bees produce honey and also honeycomb. Much about what we know of bees, we can thank a person by the name of Francois Huber. Francois was born in Geneva in 1750. He was affected by amaurosis. It's a disease in the optic nerve. So when he was 15, his eyesight began to deteriorate. His sight began to worsen until he could only see light, and after that he went completely blind. So how can you study bees? He still was very interested in bees. He came from a wealthy family, and his father paid for him to have a personal assistant, basically, as he was younger. And he worked on observation of honeybees. That was his specialty. But again, he was blind, and so he relied upon several assistants. They were thorough observations, and he wrote. Someone else did it for him, but he wrote books or wrote different results of his observations. So he had several assistants, and he had one assistant. His name was Francois as well. Must have been a popular name. His last name was Bernens. And this assistant suffered many attacks as he was trying to investigate the hives. And so they weren't very fond of that, and so Francois Huber began working on a better solution. So in 1780, he revolutionized the beehive design. He invented something called the leaf hive, and it's kind of like the leaf of a book. So he had these movable frames, much like we have today, but they were hinged on one side so you could open them up and see what was going on the inside of the hive. In addition to that, he had his hive surrounded by glass, so he was more interested in observing bees rather than beekeeping. So they had glass sides so they could see what was going on inside the hive, and it's much like what you may have had or heard of ant farms, where you have little glass boxes where you put ants in there and you can watch them do their work. His hive then went on to inspire a design that we have today that almost everyone or maybe everyone uses, where they have the boxes, the supers, and so on. But his original design was hinged on one side. After they came up with that design and they could observe the bees in a better way, they were able to divide the bee colonies more easily. And for the first time, when they divided their hives, they did not create swarming. That was one problem that they had before. And they also could remove honeycomb and still leave the brood, which is the eggs, the larvae, and the pupae, intact. So Huber, with the help of his wife and his servant, they meticulously documented the bee behavior. Bees have four life stages. It's the egg, the larva, the pupa, and the adult. The length of each stage depends on the bee's role in the colony. There are three kinds of bees in the hive. It's the queen, workers, and the drones. So the egg stage. In the beehive, we've got a queen, and her job is to lay eggs. That's all she does, basically. She keeps the hive moving, going, but she lays eggs. She'll back into an empty cell, and she'll lay an egg. But there's more than one kind of cell. So when the worker bees want females, which are other worker bees, when they want females, they will build a cell that's a standard-sized cell. These cells are usually found near the center of the brood nest. When the queen lays an egg in that standard-sized cell, she's laying a fertilized egg, and it will become a female, which is a worker bee. When the workers want males, which are drones, in the hives, they'll build cells that are considerably larger. And these cells are usually found in a section off by themselves. And the queen will lay an egg inside each one of those cells, and when she does that, she's laying an unfertilized egg. She's able to do that. And when she lays an unfertilized egg, it will become a male or a drone. So then all of these eggs, male or female, worker or drone, after 3 days, these eggs will hatch into worm-like larvae with no legs, wings, or antennae. All bee larvae, workers, drones, and queens, are initially fed royal jelly. Royal jelly is a milky substance that's secreted by a gland that's found in a worker bee's head. Workers and drones, those larvae, will stop getting that royal jelly after 3 days, and they'll be switched over to bee bread. Bee bread is made by the workers, and it's made up of fermented bee pollen, and it's mixed with nectar, honey, and bee saliva. It's nutrition dense, and it's protein rich. The larvae that's destined to be a queen continues with the royal jelly. I suppose that's why it's called royal jelly. If you keep getting fed royal jelly, you'll become a queen. So all the others get fed for 3 days and then switch to bee bread, but the larvae that's going to be a queen continues to be fed royal jelly. Constantly, consistently fed that throughout the whole larval period. And then we have the pupa stage. At the end of the larva stage, the workers will put a wax cap on top of the cell. If they put, well, on the worker cell, if you observe it, the cap will be flat. But on the drone cells, they'll be domed. We're familiar with a caterpillar and how it pupates into a cocoon before it hatches into a butterfly. So that's what's happening inside the cell. The larva will spin a cocoon. It will pupate. It will develop eyes, legs, wings, and other adult features. And then it will hatch into an adult bee after about 12 days. I looked at different sources, and there were different days, but they were all kind of in there. So if you are a beekeeper and I'm giving you the wrong date or the day, please forgive me. I told you that the length of each stage depends on the bee's role in the colony. It depends if they're a queen, a drone, or a worker. Queens will emerge in 16 days, workers will emerge 18 to 22 days, and drones will emerge in 24 days. That empty brood is quickly cleaned out by the worker bees and readied for more eggs, new eggs. The size of the workers, they're the smallest. The drones are about 50% bigger than workers, and then the queens are twice the size of worker bees. Queens can live 2 to 3 years. In the summer, worker bees live between 2 and 4 weeks. Some say maybe up to 6 weeks, but they do not live very long. If the workers hatch late and are part of the hive that goes over the winter time, they could live up to 6 to 8 months. So it's just interesting how God has it all designed. If they are part of that long-living bee, there's a Latin term for it, and I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but it broken down as bee, honey-bearing, long-lasting. So it's the long-lasting honeybee that would live over the winter. Drones will live until they finish mating, which is around 2 months. So I told you that the typical hive has one queen. There's one queen and tens of thousands of workers and then hundreds of drones. The queen can lay up to 2,000 eggs per day. I didn't put it in my notes, I think it said if that equals out to about one every 42 or 43 seconds. She may lay several hundred thousand eggs in her lifetime. So her job is to lay eggs, but she also kind of keeps the hive going. There is a QMP, which is a queen mandible pheromone. It is a chemical scent that is put out by the queen, and it's her own. So every hive has their own scent. And it attracts the workers. It maintains the colony structure by signaling that the queen is still there, that her presence is there. And it also suppresses the worker bee's reproduction. And it maintains colony stability. If the queen dies, the bees know it within minutes from not having that scent. The workers, especially the nurse bees, realize that something's wrong and the normal activity ceases. Worker bees will build emergency queen cells to raise new queens, or at least one, sometimes more than one, from the young larvae. They've already been laid eggs. They're workers right now, but they've been being fed royal jelly and have not yet been switched over to bee bread. In one of my places that I was looking, they said there's no such thing as a queen egg. There's a worker egg and there's a drone egg. And so when they need a queen, they take one or more of the workers, keep feeding them the royal jelly. Each newly selected queen larvae is in her own queen cup. They make a wax cup. It's bigger, it's different, and they have the egg in there, and they keep feeding it the royal jelly. And remember, it hatches out bigger than the rest of the bees, so they make its own shape. It looks like a peanut shell. And I've got it in my notes later, but I'll just mention it now. Most or all of that I'm telling you, you can, if you've got internet access, you can Google this or you can look at YouTube, different things that I'm telling you. I saw pictures of the peanut shell of the queen cell. The queen larvae, the worm gets the royal jelly and then it pupates. And then it hatches. When that new queen hatches, she will pipe and quack to find her rival queens. So there's a special noise that they make. And this is if they're raising more than one queen. The rival queens will respond to that noise. And once they found each other, they will fight each other till one has killed the other. That victorious young queen flies out of the hive, mates with drones from other hives, then she returns and begins laying eggs 2 to 3 days later. After mating that one time, the queen can lay eggs for the rest of her life. A queen may live as long as 5 years, and so again, there's a difference. I told you they live 2 to 3. This one says as long as 5 years and can produce up to 1 million eggs during her lifetime. Now switching to the workers, as I mentioned before, during the summer the workers do not live very long. They only live a couple weeks. During those weeks they have a variety of jobs. The role changes as they age. First, they are hive bees. They live in the hive, and then after that they are field bees. They're out and foraging. Day 1 and 2, they're housekeepers. They clean the cells and prepare them for eggs. For food storage, they clean out the debris from the hive. Then they move on to waste removal, nectar processing, and feeding the brood, keeping the brood warm. Day 3 to 5, they're feeding old larvae. Day 6 to 11, they're feeding younger larvae. They're also nursing. They're feeding larvae with royal jelly or bee bread and tending to the queen. Days 12 to 17, they have a wax gland. I'll talk about that later. I wasn't quite sure, do I talk about this now or later? You need this before you need that. You need that before you need this. But when their wax gland becomes active in their second week as adult bees, they begin building and repairing honeycomb. They secrete a beeswax, they build new honeycomb and repair old comb and process the incoming nectar that is turning into honey. They also fan their wings to circulate air and regulate the hive's temperature. Days 18 to 21, as they get older, they take on guard duty. The guards will stand, they'll sit there in the entrance of the hive, and they're guarding against intruders. Anyone that comes in, any bee that comes in that does not smell like their hive, they chase them off, that you don't belong in this hive. It also could be like a bear or a person coming to get some honey to mess with the hive. So they're guards. They also receive nectar from other bees. And then day 22 to 35 to 45, after 3 weeks, their wax glands shrink. And these wax glands, that's how they make their honeycomb. So they are no longer able to make that wax for the honeycomb. They move out of the hive and they spend the rest of their lives foraging for food and water. Foraging is the final and most dangerous job, and they fly outside of the hive, they collect nectar, pollen, water, and propolis, and they begin hunting for food. Days 35 to 45, the bees will go out of the hive to die, so as to keep the hive clean. So I didn't read this anywhere, but my thought is possibly the reason why they have the older bees go out and do the foraging at the very end is so that when they die, they won't be in the hive. But they're very meticulously, they always try to keep their hive clean, and they do not want to die inside the hive. Honeybees plan for the future. For future winter, they store up honey for food. I think I read or heard today, I was still looking at it, and I think they make 7 times as much as they actually need. They also are planning for future generations, as in making cells for workers and cells for drones, and they also do quick emergency plans when they need a queen. Drones. So we talked about the queen, the workers, now the drones. The drones depend on the workers to feed them because the drones' tongues are not long enough to feed themselves. They cannot get to the nectar themselves. So they're present in the colony only in the summer. Their only function is to mate with a new queen from another hive, and once it mates, the drone dies. Food becomes scarce when they get closer to wintertime, so the workers, in the fall, the workers will stop feeding them and push them out of the hive and let them die. In general, I think I mentioned this, but in general, the cells containing the eggs developing bees are in the center of the hive. The bees store pollen and honey above and around that brood cell, brood nest, and the same cells that are in the hive can be used for different purposes. During the summer, they're raising more young bees. During the winter, production stops for the brood, and they're using those cells for storing honey through the winter. So the workers, they're cleaning, they're feeding, they're making comb, they're heating, they're cooling the hive, they're guarding, they're bringing in nectar, they're bringing in water, pollen, propolis, dehydrating the nectar, and capping the honeycomb once the honey has been made. We'll talk about the honeycomb. Bees are seen as architects. And the honeycomb is one of nature's most amazing creations. It's comprised of vertical walls of hollow, thin-walled hexagons. And you've probably seen honeycomb for sale already. I've got a box up here. You can look at it after we're done. The boxes are always a certain thickness, and that's the reason why is they don't make them any thicker than that. Their cells are only a certain depth. And so they do them vertically, and it can be done in the wild. It can also be where mankind has made frames for them, but they always have them hanging in vertically, and that's how they create them. It becomes the stairway or the floor, the ceiling. It's the way the bees get around. They don't actually fly when they're in the hive. They're walking. They're crawling around on the honeycomb. It's also a storage area for pollen, nectar, bee bread, honey, and the developing bee larvae. The honeycomb is vital for the colony's sustenance, the reproduction, and also the communication. The honeycomb construction requires the effort of many worker bees. And I talk about the workers. Those are all females. The females are all workers, except for the queen. Again, the drones just sit around and ask to be fed. So not something that we necessarily need to take as a life lesson for us fellows. In order to make honeycomb, the young worker bees need to produce wax. In order to produce wax, the bees need to consume a lot of honey. And this is one thing that I believe Huber discovered as one of his research things, that it takes a lot of honey to produce wax. They weren't sure how the wax was created, but I don't think they can make that wax unless they're eating a lot of honey. When the young workers eat a lot of honey, they secrete or extrude beeswax in small flat scales through 8 specialized glands in their abdomen. The queen does not have this wax gland, nor do the drones. As the wax builds up, it flakes off into clear flat scales. Other worker bees collect these wax scales and chew them to soften them and make them pliable and ready to build comb. The workers form a chain. They link their legs together, and this is called festooning. Basically, they're making a scaffolding, and they use their mandibles, their legs, and they meticulously shape little bits of wax into honeycomb. They work from the frame, the hive frame, and they keep attaching new sides to these existing cells, creating a strong, interconnected network. The workers vibrate their flight muscles to produce heat, just like they do when it's cold outside, to produce heat in the hives. And this heat also makes the wax malleable so that they can form it. The math behind this production is remarkable. Worker bees produce 8 scales of wax per 12 hours. It takes 454,000 scales to make 1 pound of beeswax. To make 1 pound of beeswax, bees must consume 6 to 8 pounds of honey. To produce that much honey, they must gather 40-plus pounds of nectar. To gather this much nectar, honeybees must visit 12 to 16 million flowers. It takes a hive between 2 weeks and 2 months to produce the comb needed to store that honey necessary to feed the colony through the winter. So if you were paying attention there, 40-plus pounds of nectar becomes 6 to 8 pounds of honey. So the nectar coming in is sweet water, basically, and it needs to be dehydrated down to, it needs to be 18% water, and then it's honey. Now, there is something called tessellation. I'm not sure that I had heard of it before, but it's a word, tessellation. Honeycomb, and this was something that got me started checking it out. It was one of the quotes that I was reading. It said, honeycomb, the bee honeycomb is composed of repeated 6-sided cells arranged in hexagonal tessellation. This shape allows the bees to store the maximum amount of honey using the least amount of wax and efficiently fill a given space without gaps or overlaps. So everyone's familiar with what a honeycomb looks like, right? They're 6-sided cells and they're all pushed up against each other. And if you look at them from the end, there's no air spaces, there's no gap. So I looked up tessellation. It's a repeated pattern of one or more shapes that fit together perfectly on a surface without any gaps or overlaps. So put there by the Creator, we see that in honeycomb. We also see that pattern in a milk snake. It's on its skin, I suppose. It's also found in architecture. You think of a checkerboard. Those are squares pushed up against each other with no air spaces between. Red and black or white and black squares. You also see those patterns in like linoleum floor or tile floor. And it's found in art. There's an artist. His name was M.C. Escher. And he used a lot of tessellation in his artwork, but it's also found in ancient Roman mosaics and Islamic art and so on. So what shapes are unable to tessellate? Well, there are shapes that can be. You can do squares, you can do rectangles, you can do triangles. And then it said these shapes are unable to tessellate by themselves. Circles and ovals cannot tessellate. And this is an interesting quote. I wrote this down exactly the way it came off the internet. It said, not only do they not have angles, but you can clearly see it is impossible for the series of circles next to each other, to put a series of circles next to each other without a gap. And then I put in my notes, but God. So when the bees are making their honeycomb, they actually are not making hexagons. They vibrate their flight muscles. They connect the cylinders. They're cylinders. They're wax cylinders. They connect these cylinders together, and they form straight lines, much like if you are blowing bubbles and two bubbles pop together, they have a straight line between them. That's what's happening with these cylinders, like straws. They're turning into hexagons later. The bees aren't there with their rulers measuring and making hexagon shapes. They're just connecting cylinders, straws. They're using their mandibles and legs and meticulously shaping the softened wax into cylinder shapes. These cylinder shapes are about the size of worker bees, just a little bit bigger, about 5.5 millimeters wide and 11 millimeters deep. Then they connect the cylinders together. While the honeycomb are hexagonal in their final shape, the bees start building circular cells, but the warm, soft wax gets pulled into hexagons by the surface tension of the wax at the junction of the three cells. The hexagons of the honeycomb are the result of the wax cells naturally settling into this shape due to the surface tension as they heat and they join together. So again, remember we talked about the efficiency and the strength and the efficient design of that, but it was not the bees that made the hexagons. They made the straw shape, the cylinders, and God allowed those to form into hexagons as they work on the honeycomb. How is honey made? Honey is made, workers go out, they fly from flower to flower using their long tongues, and they collect nectar from the flower's pool of sugary water. Now, we already talked about the wax sheets that come off, and you might say, oh, gross, they take these wax sheets and they chew on them. It's kind of the same way here with the nectar. The nectar is stored in a special honey stomach, where the enzymes of the bee's salivary glands break down the nectar's complex sugars into simple sugars, glucose and fructose. Then they regurgitate that and they transfer it. They get back to the hive and they bring it back up and they give it to another bee and it swallows it into its honey stomach. And they keep doing that. They keep passing that around from bee to bee. So if you eat honey, it's coming from the nectar that has been swallowed and brought back up several times. They transfer that from bee to bee in the hive. And remember I talked about the different jobs that the workers have. They stay in the hive. They're not out foraging. So the younger bees are getting this. That's part of some of their job is to collect the nectar and keep passing it around. Through the process of repeated regurgitation and fanning with their wings, the bees remove water from the nectar. Once the nectar has a lower water content, it's transformed into honey, and it needs to be typically around 18% water. They store the honey in the honeycomb. The cells are then capped with wax to preserve the honey. Once it's sealed like that, the honey can potentially last forever. Honey is made of sugars, enzymes, minerals, vitamins, amino acids, and pollen. Don't think it's in my notes, but I think I read somewhere that they said that one reason why honey is easier to digest is because it's already been digested several times. So the bee has done the work for you. A honey bee, a worker, only makes an average of 1/12 of a teaspoon of honey in her lifetime. A pound of honey is made by 2 million flower visits. To make 1 pound, a hive of bees must fly a combined distance of around 55,000 miles. And so it's very interesting. Now we'll talk about the waggle dance. Bees communicate while they're on the honeycomb. That's where they communicate. They're constantly walking up to the queen. They're touching her with their antennae, distributing her pheromone around the beehive. And it's like, yep, she's still here, she's still well, we're good. And they keep working. Bees will sometimes shake each other, shake other bees to let them know that there's work to be done. When a bee finds a promising food source, it passes on that information when it returns to the hive, and it passes that on through what's called the waggle dance. The waggle dance will inform, it has three parts to it. And it will inform the other bees of the direction of the food source, the distance, how far the food is away, and it will also say how good the food source is or how much. So the dance is in a figure eight pattern. It's made up of two phases. There's a waggle phase and a return phase. And anyway, by the time it's done, it comes back around in a figure eight on the hive on top of the honeycomb. And the bees will complete 1 to 100 of these. The direction and the number of circuits will tell the observing bees the location, the distance, and the size. So the direction, how do they figure out the direction? When the bee is moving about in this waggle dance and it's pointing. Okay, so the way it was explained was, picture the sun. So you see the sun out there, and it's up in the air. Draw a line straight down. So that's where the sun lands. It goes down over the horizon. Now, if the bee is doing its waggle dance inside the hive at a five-degree angle from the sun, that line, then the bees know that they need to go out and fly 5 degrees away from the sun, and that's the direction of their honey or their source. Not honey yet. And then the duration of the waggle dance indicates how far. And the longer and more vigorous the waggle, it's the greater the distance. And then the repetition shows how good the food source is. The excitement, the duration of the dance can convey the quality of food. The dancing bee also carries the scent of the flower patch. So they have very good sense of smell. And so they'll also smell what this sample of nectar smells like, and then they know they're heading in the right direction with the smell as well. Bees have a very good sense of direction. It's kind of like before our time, GPS. They are following the sun, and they also are able to do something with the magnetic field of the earth. So they are very, very accurate. They fly out. They can fly out a couple miles away and then come back. They go to the correct source according to the waggle dance, and they come right back to the correct hive. All right, protecting the hive. There's guard bees. I mentioned that. The middle-aged worker bees. They inspect all the incoming bees, and they check for the correct odor. If there's a problem, whether it's a bear or the wrong, kind of bee coming in, if there's a threat, those guard bees will put out an alarm pheromone. They have their own smell that they'll put out, and they say it smells like bananas. I don't know how they figured that out, but they said they put out their own smell. It smells like bananas, and all the other bees come to their help. And once that alarm is raised, there's a defense of all the bees. They perform a coordinated attack, and they might even sting the intruder to death. Bees are able to warm and cool their hive. They maintain a 92 to 93 degree Fahrenheit temperature in their brood nest at all times. It doesn't matter if it's 110 outside or 40 degrees. It says negative 40 degrees. They can use evaporative cooling. They don't like to bring water into the hive unless they have to. So if it's really hot, they'll bring water in, drop it on the comb, and then they'll fan their wings, and that'll cool it. It promotes evaporation. They can fan. They can stand outside the edge of the hive and fan and get air circulating through. They also do bearding, where they all hook together or stand beside each other outside the hive, and it helps protect the sun. It reduces how many are in the hive, so that it improves some ventilation as well. Then during the winter, they can form a winter cluster. They all huddle together and buzz. And they vibrate their thoracic flight muscles, and it's called shivering. They also take turns, that way one of them doesn't freeze to death. Some of them are in where it's warm, and the others are out near the edges, and they keep switching places. There's also heater bees. The heater bees maintain a hive warmth by vibrating their wing muscles to create friction. This generates heat from their bodies. They do this by moving face down into the empty cells and vibrating to raise their body temperature to around 111 degrees. Bees are pollinators. They are the most frequent single pollinator in the world, and they visit thousands of flowers daily. They collect pollen on their pollen basket. We had some purple flowers that bloomed a couple weeks ago, and I was looking at really closely at it, and there were several bees flying around, and one had big, by the size of the bee, big pollen pockets on its back legs, and they were collecting pollen. They put nectar in their nectar stomach, and they put pollen in their pollen basket, and they need both. They feed bee bread to the other bees, and so they need pollen in that. Pollen sticks to their hairy bodies as they move. They visit the flowers. They move from flower to flower, and some of the pollen is transferred, and it pollinates the next plant, and it allows it to reproduce. They pollinate vast crops, food crops like almonds, apples, blueberries, oranges, and more than 75% of the food that we eat depends on pollinators. And bees are one of the best. Many beekeepers will actually pack up their bees and head down to Florida, and they'll pollinate the orange groves, and then they'll work their way up through the states as the flowering, the blossoms come due or start blooming in different areas of the states. And they can make honey from a variety of things: autumn flowers, spring flowers, orange blossom, blueberry blossom. There's different blossoms, so there's different honey made from those. I'm going to talk about the uses of honey a little bit. Honey has a lower glycemic index than table sugar. It raises the blood glucose more slowly. And the sugars, glucose and fructose, they're more readily absorbed by the body. There is a health risk. There's some things put out there by the health experts. They say expectant mothers and children under 12 months old and anyone with bee venom allergies might avoid eating honey. Honey is an excellent sweetener. It's 25% sweeter than sugar, so you don't have to put as much on to make it just as sweet. When I was a boy, honey was our sweetener. We did not use sugar. We did in cooking, but not. We put honey on our toast, in our tea, and on our unsweetened cereal like cornflakes. It has medicinal value, can lower blood pressure, soothe sore throats, and reduce coughing. Antioxidants, it can help reduce inflammation. also provide relief for swelling and pain. And also eating unfiltered, unheated raw honey produced in your area, which is a 50-mile radius or less, is like receiving a natural anti-allergy shot. Now, there were some pros and cons on that. I don't know if that's accurate, but that's what it said, that it can help with allergies. Also, it can help with wound healing, has antibacterial and antioxidant properties. It can help reduce infection. When I was growing up, we often would mix equal parts of honey and flour and put it on a Band-Aid, put it on a sore. It works kind of like a drawing salve for a splinter, for a scrape, for a sore. There's also beeswax. Beeswax is used in a multitude of things, furniture polish and so on. It can also be made into candles. And they're the only candles known to improve air quality. I stopped by Mitchell's Honey on Kenner Road 50, and they had a little store there, and I was going to buy, well, I bought several things, but I was going to buy a little candle too. And they were out. They were out for the season. They're not going to have any more beeswax, more candles until the fall or the winter when they harvest their honey. I think it's 8 pounds of honey, and that equals 1 pound of beeswax. So they were out of candles. But the beeswax candles are known to cause dust and pollen to fall to the ground, and then it releases the slightest little bit of hint of beeswax and honey into the air as well. And it can be used as a lubricant for like wooden drawers. Beekeeping has been around for quite some time. The Egyptians were probably the first ones that did it. They kept bees in twig and reed designed hives. Also through history, their one thing that they would have done was hollow logs, probably cut a square or something off the side of it, put it back in, and when the bees would go in and create their hives and their honey, they'd pull that out. But again, the kind of hives that we have today do not disturb the larvae. The brood, that's what I wanted. It said if you keep more than one hive at one place, you are a beekeeper. Generally speaking, beekeepers have 1 to 2 acres for 2 to 3 beehives. And after I was grown and left home, my dad took up some beekeeping. He just had a couple hives, just kind of tinkered around with it. And I remember us visiting them in Pennsylvania. And he said, I want to see if there's mites in here. They have problems with mites sometimes. And so he went and got powdered sugar, got a couple bees, put it in the container and put the lid on, shook it around. And he said, oh, the bees like sugar. And you could see right away these little black mites. If there were mites in there, you could see that on the white powdered sugar. And he said, oh, I'm going to have to treat them. And I think he had sugar water and some kind of medicine that he mixed together and that would treat them for the mites. Healthy hives can house 20 to 80,000 bees. And healthy hives have 2 to 3 honey supers. And so they keep their brood down below and they put supers up above. And they can produce 30 to 60 pounds of honey in a year, each one of the hives. Beekeepers, you may have noticed them using smoke already. They will use smoke and it makes the bees more docile and less likely to sting. It also masks that alarm pheromone that smells like banana. And it prevents other bees from feeling like they need to come and attack. Beekeepers also wear white clothes because dark clothing, darker items, will scare the bees more quickly. For example, a brown or black bear. Think of the color. So beekeepers often will wear light-colored clothes. It's also cooler during the summer. Aristotle, 384 years B.C. to 322 B.C., he was known as the father of science. And he originally thought that the big bee was a king. That thought persisted for close to 2,000 years. He did a lot of writing on animals and nature. And then there was, they finally discovered, no, it's not a king, it's a queen. But Aristotle thought it was a king. Fermented honey, known as mead, M-E-A-D, was first produced in ancient China. It's possibly the world's oldest alcoholic beverage. And that was given to newlywed couples. It was a month's worth of mead. And it was honey wine. And that was a typical gift back then. And that's where you get the word honeymoon. Comes from the honey wine. King Tut's tomb was opened in 1922. It was a 3,000-year-old honey in there. It's still edible. Honey does not spoil. It's the only food that never spoils. When out foraging, the worker bees can fly 15 to 20 miles an hour, and they beat their wings 200 times a second, and it creates that buzz. The exact note varies, but the sound that they produce often tends to be in the key of C. Bees are attracted to caffeine. They aren't the only creatures that are. It says, studies have shown that caffeine consumption actually improves the honeybee's memory and learning capabilities. Honeybees' brains are the size of a sesame seed. Humans have two eyes, and each eye has one lens. Honeybees have five eyes, three smaller eyes on the top, kind of form a triangular shape, and that's how they keep in line with the sun, orient themselves to the sun. The two larger compound eyes have thousands of lenses. The workers have 6,900 lenses, and the drones have 8,600 lenses in each eye. Those lenses are in the shape of a hexagon. So they have, the workers have 6,900 hexagon lenses in each eye. Their eyes, their lenses are textured with that same pattern as the honeycomb, and they fit like a tiled floor, so there's no gaps in between. And because of those lenses, each lens is sending a picture back to the brain, and they have a mosaic vision. They see fuzzy, pixelated-like images. In Genesis 9:14, it talks about the rainbow, and in verse 16 it said, it's talking about God, I will look upon it between God and every living creature. I'm skipping over words, but his rainbow that he put in there was between God and every living creature. It wasn't just mankind, even though we think of that when it storms, we look, oh, God's not going to flood the earth, the whole earth again. There's the promise. The colors of the rainbow, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. That's what we see when we look up into the sky. The red is always at the top of the bow, and we see that. There's actually more colors than that, but we can't see them. There's a color before red, and there's a color after violet. The one before red is called infrared. The one after violet is ultraviolet. So we see from red to violet, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, violet. Bees cannot see red, so they move forward one color on the spectrum, and they see orange, yellow, green, blue, violet, ultraviolet. So they see one less than we do and one more than we do. That's another interesting thing. If you have access to the internet, check it out. What do bees see when they look at a flower? It looks completely different than what we see. They see intricate ultraviolet light patterns that are on the flower petals, something we can't see. It's glowing brightly, and it shows off a whole new set of colors. It's invisible to humans, but it functions like a landing strip. These landing strips guide the bees right to the center of the flower where the nectar is located. It reveals also which flowers have been visited by other insects. And so the bees don't have to waste their time on a flower that's already been there. Bees have 170 odor receptors, and they have a sense of smell that's 50 times more powerful than a dog. And because of this, because of the bees' acute sense of smell, they can be trained to detect explosives, bombs, and landmines, as well as other chemicals of interest. Drones do not have a stinger. Workers and queens have a stinger. When the workers sting, their stinger is barbed and it stays in the person or thing that is stinging and they die. A queen, its stinger is smooth and it does not stay in the like the enemy queen that is stinging. And so they're able to sting multiple times and survive. Now, I think I alluded to it, that the worker bees never, I never said it, but they never mate. But they also don't lay eggs. And one of the statements I saw says they never lay eggs, but that's not true. They don't typically lay eggs. Remember the queen's pheromone in the cell, in the hive, it suppresses their reproduction. And so if the queen dies and they don't get a replacement queen fast enough, their reproduction system will mature, and they'll actually be able to lay eggs. But it's not typically, because they can work fast, they can quickly feed more royal jelly to the larvae and get a queen fast enough that they don't have to lay eggs on their own. All right. I have more notes than I want to talk about, I think. There's a couple comments that we say, busy as a bee. Why don't we say busy as a chihuahua? They're active, but bees are active and also productive. Make a beeline. The reason why we say make a beeline is because bees fly straight, and they have that GPS, and it gets them right there and right back. Another one is buzzing like a beehive. And the definition here was, beehive epitomizes the ideal model for getting things done as a group with clear roles and responsibilities, but also individual autonomy to get busy and do what is needed to be done. So we could maybe say the haystack supper last night was buzzing like a beehive. I know that there were some moments where people were flustered, but we had roles, we had responsibilities, and we were working together. And if you see something, you see a video of a beehive with all the bees on there, they're just moving all about, but they all have jobs and they're all doing something. All right, in Romans 1:20, I think it was read this morning, but something stuck out to me. It was either that or something close by, and I just happened to see it. It says, the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen. I think it's talking spiritually, but I just thought that was interesting how the ultraviolet, we can't see it, and yet the invisible things, we can't see it, are clearly seen by the bees. Also in Revelation 4:11, it says, thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. So we get a bang out of watching bees and eating honey and that kind of thing, but they were for God's pleasure. Now, just quickly here, see if I can get some answers here. Who sent his sons to Egypt? Said, take the best of the fruits of the land to your vessels, carry them down to the man with the present, a little balm, a little honey, spices, myrrh, nuts, and almonds. Who sent his sons to Egypt? Jacob. Who found honey and honeycomb and honey in the carcass of a lion? Samson. Who ate honey that he found in the woods during a battle, not knowing that his father the king commanded that nobody was to eat? Jonathan. Who is the king that was on a run and was given much food, including honey? David. Yes. And I've got the verses here. It says, brought beds and basins and earthen vessels and wheat and barley and flour and parched corn and beans and lentils and parched pulse and honey and butter and sheep. And it just went on and on. It was David. Who ate a piece of broiled fish and a honeycomb when he asked for food? Jesus. What is sweeter than honey and the honeycomb? Yeah, it says the judgments of the Lord. So, you know, you've got the statutes, the law, judgments, all that. But I had to think of that where honey is 25% sweeter than sugar, and God's word, or God, yeah, is sweeter than that yet. All right. Psalm 119:103 says, "How sweet are thy words unto my taste, yea, sweeter than honey to my mouth." So there's another comment like that. In our Sunday school lesson, was it last week? Twice it mentioned about honey. And it said, if you found honey, hast thou found honey? Eat so much as sufficient for thee, lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it. So too much of sweets is not a good thing. It is not good to eat much honey. So those were the two comments from last Sunday school lesson. Because of it being subject to fermentation, honey was prohibited in the cereal offering in the Old Testament in Leviticus 2:11. Proverbs 24:13 said, "My son, eat thou honey, because it is good, and honeycomb, which is sweet to thy taste." In one comment that I read, I thought it was pretty good. It said, "The wax adds a delightfully chewy texture and a sensory experience of the wax cells full of honey exploding in your mouth is unique to eating honeycomb." So I think in our title, it said something about lessons from nature. I had some things that I wanted to mention as a wrap-up here. Lessons that we could learn from the bees. Thinking of the things that I told you, and I tried to mention them all. That's why I didn't want to skip anything because of what I have here. Be the person that God has designed you to be. Be patient in every phase of life, the egg, the larva, the pupa, and the adult stage. Nurture the immature and help the next generations. Bees don't go on strike. Bees aren't out begging for loose change. Everyone has a job that's an assignment and a responsibility. And just like the expression, too many chiefs and not enough Indians, the ratio of the leaders to the workers and drones is few to many. Have a leader. Support the leader. Work together for the common good of the hive. Help the hive thrive. Submissively work in a position that God has placed you in, if you're a leader or if you're in a supporting role. Make the Lord's work your life's work. Do something at every stage of life. Be willing to do a variety of jobs. No job is below me. We should be willing to clean the hive, prepare for the future young, prepare food, remove waste, process the nectar, feed the brood, build and repair the comb, perform guard duty and protect, forage for food and water, and care for those who have died. Ephesians 4:28 said, "Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the things which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth, not stealing, but working, providing for oneself and having some to give to others." Be willing to sacrifice oneself. A place for everything, everything in its place. Be neat, be tidy, be orderly, communicate well, follow instructions. Be willing to go great distances. Be willing to put in long hours. Be willing to carry heavy loads. Don't be afraid to get dirty. In pollination, thinking of that, we may touch, we may impact many lives through our work. Plan for the future. Store up for the future. Save for the future. Future days for the winter, future generations, future leaders, and for end of life. Prepare to help in emergency situations. Make the best of what God has given you. Enjoy the flowers. Find the good in everything, thinking of all the different blossoms and how they still can make honey from all these different blossoms. Bees communicate information about food sources. Communicate as to where to find living bread, the living bread. Bees will also shake each other to let other bees know that there's work to be done. We need to motivate and encourage each other sometimes. Hebrews 10:24-25 said, let us continue, consider one another to provoke unto love and to good works, exhorting one another. Psalm 90:12 says, "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." And you think of two or three weeks being the only lifespan of many of the workers. We have usually more than that. May our product be sweet, soothing, healing, and anti-inflammatory. May our work stand the test of time, never spoiling. Bees see ultraviolet light. May we see the good that others can't. Circles, ovals cannot tessellate. Not only do they not have angles, but you can clearly see that it is impossible to put a series of circles next to each other without a gap. But God. Allow God to do the impossible through you. Matthew 19:26 says, with God all things are possible. So that's all I have. Sorry it took me longer than you might have expected.